Thank you very much, Etienne. And now we have the opportunity, or you have the opportunity, to go into Q&A. And we'll first deal with the Q&A in the room, and then later on go to the digital Q&A. Let's start with John.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's John Hockey from Morgan Stanley. I've got three questions, please. Firstly, all on Excel, I'm afraid. So firstly, looking at the casualty reserves. So I think in the narrative that accompanied results, you were talking about litigation financing, financial lines, etc. I wonder if you could give us a little bit more commentary in terms of what specific factors you were taking into account when you were setting the reserves at year end. That's the first question. Second question, just looking at in the B slides, the B appendices, if you look at B17, if you look at the sort of volume changes versus pricing, it looks like the exposure actually went up the most in casualty and financial lines, which seems a bit surprising given those are the areas where the reserving issues emerged in the back end of the fourth quarter. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how comfortable you are with that mix of exposure movements over the course of the year. And then finally, just looking at the earnings bridge to get to the 1.2, I see there's nothing in there, unless I'm sort of missing it in other, in terms of anything for rebuilding the reserve buffer at XL. So is the message effectively that you've got sufficient aggregate reserve buffer at the group level that we shouldn't be too concerned about the sort of solo XL silo? Thank you.
Very good. I suggest that, Alban, you start with the first question and also the second question, and then Etienne, you'll go for the third question.
So good afternoon. So the first question was on the quality of the reserves and what we factor in. So when we review the reserves, obviously we look at different things, and to name only one or two. One is obviously the cost of litigations in the U.S. Only 2% of the claims that we have on casualty go to courts. 98% are settled, fortunately, obviously, before we go to court. Nevertheless, the court settlements drive the trend for the overall reserves and the claims to be paid. So that's something that we look at, and we look at it on a claims-by-claims basis, looking also, obviously, at the previous trends. The other thing that we look also, which is slightly different, though sometimes it's under the same word of social inflation, it's systemic risks, such as talc, glyphosate, opioid, child abuse, and so on. And so what we do is we review our exposure over the last 10 to 15 years on what has been our underwriting on those lines in the past. And we reassess what could be the losses given what we hear, what we see on the markets on those fronts. That's something that we monitor systematically, and that has been the case for a long time, because those systemic risks have always existed. And the third part that you should also keep in mind is that those casualty lines in the U.S. are significantly reinsured through quota shares, between 40 and 60% from one year to the other. So that obviously also reduces the impact of what I described earlier in terms of litigations or settlements. The second question was on the growth in casualty and in growth in volumes in casualty and financial lines. So I think there we need to be extremely clear that if you look at financial lines, you have a number of different aspects in that, and different aspects in terms of geography, U.S. versus Europe, and different aspects also in terms of customers, large versus mid-market. If you look at financial lines and notably D&O, the issue was more in the U.S. on large corporates. It is much safer, much sounder when you look at mid-market and European. So we shifted the underwriting from the latter to the former. And you see, despite the reduction in U.S. large, that overall we have grown the volumes on selected segments.
Thank you, Alban. Third question, Etienne, on the 1.2 billion.
Yeah, on the 1.2 billion, we have absolutely not reflected any release of provision of any kind. So the big gap was set in place originally to face with the development of prior year claims up to the end of 18. So this, we consider that it will, you know, there will be, the P gap will neutralize the possible adverse element from these years. When setting, and this, so this is neutralized. When looking at 2020, and you see how the world forward is constructed, we just have a sort of economic approach on this, right? So we started with 0.5, which embedded some good news, some bad news, but more bad news than good news. And then from this, we look at the impact of our actions, the impact of the pricing, and the cost of the, which is not the cost, earnings impact of the volatility measures. And this is how we come to 1.2. So in the 1.2, you don't have a positive from a reserves of release. If there is some allocation within the PGAP, it will be only to compensate some new views on other risks which had been identified during the PGAP and not yet allocated, which is a different mechanism. So we are not, and I think this is a key message. Why do we believe in this 1.2? Because we have all the elements which mechanically expect that in the normalized year, it will happen. And as a CFO, I feel very comfortable with this target.
Nick?
Nick Holmes at SocGen. Couple of questions again on XL. I wondered if you could give us just a little bit more color on the decision making behind the 600 million allocation. What were the key drivers? Was it environmental? Was it changes in your own conservatism, if we can call it that? And also with the 800 million, you sound extremely confident that this is a sufficient number. Can you draw on any sort of illustrations relative to market, relative to your own perception of risk profile, why you do think that this is sufficient? And then secondly, a rather simpler question, I hope, is how confident are you that XL's internal model will be approved in, I think you're saying, Q4, which is an acceleration, is it not? No. Alban is saying no.
It's at end of 2020, so. If it's in September, it's an acceleration. Yes. Good. Two questions, I think, again for Alban. On the reserves, how comfortable are we on the 600 or the 800? And then the question around the internal model.
So on the 600 million, as Etienne said, when we bought the company 18 months ago, we had identified a number of potential risk or potential issues. That led us to the booking of the PGAP reserve. And now we're saying, okay, we have more certainty on the risks and the need for booking that, or not, for identifying those reserves. And that's related to exactly what I described a minute ago in terms of U.S. casualty mainly, where we had seen that there was a deviation because of social inflation, and social inflation did not appear in 2019 nor in 2018. We had identified that at the time of the acquisition. So it's just the realization of this. Now, the 800 million buffer, at this stage, as Etienne said, we are comfortable. Now, we know that it is a business where you have some uncertainty, you have potentially large cases, and that can go one way or the other. But we think that the 600 million allocation today is sufficient, and that the 800 million is a good enough buffer against that potential volatility. Again, having done that analysis of our potential exposures on the past to casualty, social inflation, and systemic risks. And on the internal model, so we have discussed at length with the ACPR the changes in the model and the fact that we want to include Excel in our internal model. The formal application is in June, but by then we will finalize the discussion. And you know that you submit 6 months before the approval, so we will submit in June in order to have Excel in our internal model in December as planned.
Just to add to that on the casualty piece, I mean, when you look at the whole market, if your prices are increasing by over 40%, if your exposure is significantly reduced, and if some competitors, which was the case, are even exiting the market, you have an issue of insurability. And so what you've seen always in the past, that when there are these anomalies, at some point it will come back to normality. James, maybe we can just hand the mic, is the easiest. Yeah.
James Shuck from Citi. So three from my side. I just want to go back to slide A30, if I can. So the margin over best estimate. And I'm just initially thinking of the difference between the 5.2 and the 6. Can you just explain to me what drove, so excluding the Excel part of it, what actually drove that increase in the margin over best estimate that you're showing there? And kind of linked to that, if I look at that, what's left in the PGAAP margin in XL, in relation to the reserves, it's 3% of XL reserves, and the total of the 6 is closer to 12. So, kind of returning to John's question earlier, at some stage, will you look to increase the XL margin over best estimate more towards the group adequacy level, because it's the group adequacy level that's driving the expectation for the 1.5 to 2.5 points of PYD. That's my first question. Secondly, Thomas, I mean, the 1.2 billion in 2020, that includes about 200 to 300 million probably from legacy AXA corporate solutions. So if you look at the 12.4 billion acquisition price, this is post synergies you're doing this, it looks like a kind of 7 or 8% ROI on the deal. I'd just like to get your insight into whether you think that's a sufficient number. And then finally, just around the dividend, I think you've been pretty clear that you would grow the dividend in line with underlying earnings. And you increased the payout ratio target range last year from 40 to 50 to 50 to 60. We've got this year, which is depressed earnings, so you can argue whether you've hit 50 or not. At some stage, you need to rebase that dividend up. Otherwise, what's the point in increasing that target range? If we're not going to get that this year, then we're going to be next year, perhaps. But I'd just like some guidance over how to think about that payout ratio, please.
Very good. I suggest Alban Etienne on the first question around the margin of best estimate, and then linked to the question, PGAAP, 3% of XL reserves, are you bringing it to the group adequacy level? And then I will talk about the other two questions.
So, on your first question, to the same extent, we review the Excel reserves very regularly. We review the whole group reserves very regularly. And we assess what is our best estimate liability for Solvency II purposes. It so happens that over the last year, the difference between the best estimate liabilities and the IFRS reserves has increased. Why? Simply because we can have a change in the best estimate reserve, in best estimate liabilities, that does not flow immediately through the P&L. And it might flow afterwards. And when you look at the PYD, that the BONI, the PYD positive, that we release every year, that comes fundamentally from that difference. Do we want to bring Excel to that percentage? No, not specifically, because we want to manage this at group level, and Excel is one division among others. the excess of a best estimate is not proportionally dispatched among the various entities of the group. For instance, Etienne said that this year we had positive prior year developments coming from Ogden, so it can pop up in one entity and not one another. And we're not planning to have a proportionate allocation in all our entities.
So, on the two other questions, number one is the question around the 1.2 billion in 2020. Is it post synergies still an attractive deal? Again, let's go back to the rationale of the deal at the time. The rationale was, how do we reduce our exposure in financial risk and how do we move towards technical risk? Always looking at the question, how do we make sure that we are not too much exposed to interest rate risks where we have no lever to act? So the first question would be, let's compare the exposure to Equitable against the exposure to XL. Fortunately, we have sold the totality of Equitable, but for those of you who have followed Equitable, you have certainly seen that in the last year, towards the end of the year, AXA Equitable has made a significant increase necessary in reserves when it comes to policyholder behavior. This was just below 1 billion. This would have certainly hit us had we owned 100% of Equitable. For this amount, you can allow yourself quite a few natural catastrophes. Second point, I wish AXA Corporate Solutions would have made 300 million. Unfortunately, they made only between 150 and 170 million and would have been hit exactly in the same way on the topics that we've been discussing. So no separate treatment. When we come to the question around the 1.4 or the 1.2, at the end of the day, nothing has changed. The 1.4 has been designed in AXA XL, XL at the time, plus Corporate Solutions, plus the cost synergies. We are well on track when it comes to the integration, so the cost synergies are flowing through. We still have not achieved everything, but they are flowing through. We are working on the profitability of the portfolio, which you've seen. We have taken very clear measures in uppricing the portfolio. Again, 10% increase of the premium, 10% increase on net earned premium of 10 billion is certainly a significant upside that will come through the earnings. And then thirdly, we have taken a decision, which was after the combination, the acquisition, of reducing volatility. So when we talk about 1.2 at reduced volatility or 1.4, we're talking about exactly the same thing. So for me, nothing has changed. The strategy is exactly the same. And again, coming back to my first point, have we taken the right decision of shifting our risk profile from financial to technical risk? Definitely in this environment. Your last question on the dividend. When we speak about the dividend and when we look at how do we determine the dividend, we always said we want to have an adequate and attractive growth in dividend. So what we'll do, we'll look at where do we need to position the dividend, how should we be increasing the dividend, and the payout ratio is a resulting figure of it and not the determining figure. And so that's why you see with the board, we have been very comfortable to have a 7% increase in the dividend, which is more, as you stated yourself, than the 5% underlying earnings per share. But we took account of the fact that we had more than normal natural catastrophes. And by the way, it was the same for the full year of 2018 that came to the 7% dividend. And that's how we will continue to look at it. The first question is, how do we get to an attractive dividend growth? And the resulting figure is the payout ratio. And I guess what you're saying, between 50 and 60%, we are still at the lower end and there is a big room for flexibility.
Could I just clarify one point? Yes. I mean, one way of hitting that is to shrink earnings, I suppose. So let's hope you don't go that way. But if
I wasn't thinking about this way.
But if you want to, I mean, if you're going to raise the target range, I mean, are you categorically ruling out a rebasing of the dividend to the midpoint of the range at some stage and then grow in line with underlying earnings?
The reason why we changed the range at the time was exactly the change in the risk profile and taking account of the fact that we have more volatility through natural catastrophes. You've been following AXA for a long time. The volatility of Equitable, which was also very high, was always absorbed to the DAX, so you didn't really see the volatility because it was inherent in the deferred acquisition costs. Here we don't have that mechanism. What is volatile here is volatile at the bottom. And so we said, in order to take account of this and to make sure that we have the flexibility of breathing, we need to move from the initial payout ratio of 55 to 50 to 60. But always in the spirit, number one criterion is we need to have and determine what is attractive dividend growth, and the payout ratio is the resulting figure. Let's move. Sorry, I can't see who it is because the light is very difficult.
Thank you. It's William Hawkins from KBW. Picking up on one of the points you just made to James, and you made a lot about the improvement in the volatility in Excel, I'm surprised that you have been clear about the earnings hit of your de-risking, but you haven't been clear about the capital benefit of your de-risking. I mean, if you bought more reinsurance protection, your volatility has gone down. There should be some capital release from that. So if you were able to say to us, look, we've freed up $2 billion of capital from this, for example, that would usefully offset the downside to earnings. So I'm surprised you haven't been clear about the capital freed up. Could you be clearer about the capital freed up, please? And then secondly, with regards to the cash buffer rebuild, Etienne, that you showed on slide 31, you showed that $1.9 billion of cash buffer rebuild. Can you just remind us where we are with regards to the stock on that number? My original memory, correct me if I'm wrong, was that when you did the Excel deal, you talked about cash at hand of $3.5 billion being spent. If we just subtract the $1.9 billion from that, are we saying that you've got another $1.6 billion to go? Or is the number bigger or smaller?
Those were your two questions. So thanks, Will. First one is for Alban. Is there a capital release from the further protection? Second one for Etienne, where is the stock on the cash?
So I'm afraid I have to be a bit technical for a second, so bear with me. When the way our internal model is built, there is a benefit of diversification. And when you look at the investment risk, there is little diversification from one country to another, because when you have a crisis, that goes everywhere. So when you hedge your financial risks, you do have immediately a benefit on your capital. Going to your question on hedging or reducing our insurance risks, because there is a lot of diversification, because when you had a windstorm in Japan, you don't have at the same time necessarily a casualty issue in the US. Reducing hedging part of the book doesn't lead to a significant amount of capital reduction because of the benefit of diversification from what is done locally to what is needed at group level. You see what you mean? So if I were to do a 50% quota share of my whole book in PNC, yes, you would see it. But reducing the cat nat from 500 million at 20 years to 400 million, you would hardly see it in the capital required.
Farouk, I think, yeah. Sorry.
So the second question
was... Sorry. Yeah, the stock, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Too fast.
Around 2 billion.
Hi, Farouk Kenny from Credit Suisse. Firstly, on the walk to get to the 1.2 billion, when I look at the 600 million uplift, I think to myself, you talked about 400 million pre-tax synergies. You had 200 million of excess large losses last year. Pricing drives the top line, but also margin expansion, presumably. So what's a negative factor in that 600 that you haven't really talked about? It's question one. Question two, I personally am quite surprised that you are reducing risk in property. I agree that you've got a reinsurance business and it's volatile. and you probably want to reduce exposure there. But given where, yeah, given the strong increase in property pricing, also the fact that it's quite a short tail business. So yes, you reduce volatility, but you don't get things biting you. If you excuse my French, at the backside, you know, 5 years later, which is what we're seeing in social inflation. So why tilting more towards long tail business, which, you know, pricing might be going up, but it's going up for a reason. Just wanted to understand the philosophy. And then lastly, on the cash holding, I mean, you started to show this number now, and I was kind of wondering what significance it has. So next year, obviously, we'll get this, it sounds like another 2 billion hit from buffer rebuild. But over time, obviously, this is build, given your payout ratio, given your earnings. So just kind of wondering what level would you like to have at the holding? Why are you showing this number, in essence? Thank you.
So I suggest, Etienne, you take the first question. Why 0.6 was the negative factors? Then the question on reducing property are quickly answered, and then, Etienne, you'll go back to the holding question. When it comes to property and when it comes to taking risk, it's always the question what you get for the risk. You are absolutely right that prices are increasing, and what you see as a phenomenon, and Scott will certainly agree with that prices in primary insurance are increasing far more than prices in reinsurance. So you have roughly a factor of 1 to 2. So we have in primary insurance 10 to 12%, in reinsurance 5 to 6% if you look at the renewal. So yes, prices are increasing, but you have to ask yourself, are they increasing enough so you can make a decent return? And what you've seen certainly in the property area is that there is a lot of alternative capital streaming into this market because they have exactly the same logic that we have applied with our own portfolio. How can I go into risks that are not correlated with financial risks? And if I was a pension fund, not being subject to Solvency II, not maybe being subject to the same economic rationale that an AXA is, not having a 16% return on equity, they will come in with a very different view, and they will write that risk for, I don't know, 5% return on equity. This is not what we can afford. So you have to see how do you balance your exposure, that you, yes, get the right price and get the premium increase, but also that you get the right return. And at the moment, in particular in reinsurance, we are in some areas, and notably in Europe, not at the right levels of return. Therefore, the exposure reduction, you've seen that the 10% exposure reduction that we mentioned is linked to the reinsurance nat cat area, and that's the rationale. Etienne, question number 1 and 3.
So we start, the question refers to 0.6. The 0.6 reflects mainly the pricing effect, net of the possible claims inflation. That's it. So when you start from the 0.5, of course you have 0.2 deviation in large losses. We have not said for the large losses that there would be a reversal to the means, because this works for the natural catastrophes. We have models. For large losses, it's not the same mechanics. So we are not averaging the large losses. They are in the 0.5, and we consider that they stay. I don't say this is what will happen. I just say this is how we build our forecast, right, in a very structured way. So it's mostly the pricing net of inflation. There are, of course, some cost synergies, but as Thomas was saying, they are well advanced. So if we speak about big numbers, I really think this is the pricing net of further claims inflation. Knowing that what I said for large losses is so true for the social inflation impact, it's in the 0.5, and we don't say it comes back to zero immediately and we rebase everything. So the 0.6 encapsulates all those different items. The second question, why do you show that? I must confess that we get always a lot of questions about the cash variation in the holding, and therefore I thought you would be pleased to see that and that you would not ask us, why do you show us what we want you to show us? So Thank you very much for your question, but I was not prepared for this one. So, seriously speaking, we are, on the long run, we are happy with some cash buffer at the holding level. Just in case, you know, there would be a very stress test for, let's say, 1 year of financial catastrophes or whatever. So between, let's say, 1 and 3 billion, we are happy. The intention is not to build, you know, like Microsoft, 100 billions of euros in cash and not returning it to the shareholders. So the message here is really bringing clarity on what are the flows so that you can better understand. There is no hidden message. And we will not put as a headline, you know, the level of cash in the holding in the front page. Never. It's just to give you a hint of where we are and how we manage the cash.
Just a quick comment, rather than a question. It seems to me that you've lost the cost synergies, or the general revenue and cost synergies, because they weren't quite there in 2019. We didn't really talk about them. In 2020, they were going to come, but now they seem to be gone. So, yeah.
No, yeah. Cost synergies started in 18, continued in 19. I must confess that in terms of cost, we had some slightly positive element, non-recurring for next year, but the synergies will continue to play in 2020. But, you know, if you look at, if you compare that to the impact of pricing, it's much lower. But don't forget that it was already in the 18 and 19 numbers. So when thinking about 20, you cannot take the 250 million euros total announced because part of them were already in the previous numbers.
Let's just move. Sorry, I can't see.
Hi, thank you. Ashik Masudi from JP Morgan. Sorry to go back on that 600 million number again. I mean, if that is net of price, net of the claims inflation, I mean, was that already expected when you gave the 1.4 billion number? Because pricing more or less happened last year, and 1.4 billion number was given before that, if I'm not wrong. I mean, I've just started following AXA more closely for the last 6 months. So any thoughts on that? I'm just a bit confused on that one. So that's first one. Secondly, you mentioned that some of the pricing improvement will follow in 2021 as well, and more volumes, the 10% volume growth will follow in 2021. So how should we think about that? What sort of numbers are we talking about? Is it an incremental number, or is it still within the range bound of 1.2 billion? And lastly, just one simple question, maybe a bit naive question, but you mentioned that the volatility would most likely go down. I mean, what are we talking about here in terms of volatility? I mean, let's say we have another 2019 in 2020. What sort of Excel number would be? What sort of profit Excel would print? Thank you.
So, Etienne, it's best if you take those three questions. I think for the third question, we should maybe have a look at one of the slides, B39 or whatever it was, or 59, I can't remember.
B52,
sorry, exactly. Etienne.
So, I must say that back to 18, when the target of 1.4 was set, a lot of things were different. So we expected certainly a lower level of large losses. And we expected social inflation, but not by the magnitude and the speed of increase we are facing now. So, and of course, at the same time, we didn't expect such high level of prices. So I think it's pretty clear. And therefore, a lot of things have changed. And if you look at the end of the day, what Thomas was saying, what's the difference between 1.4 and 1.2? It's just the same with less volatility and less risks. So this is another way to look at it. So yes, certainly, we didn't expect so much volatility on the market, on this market. And to make the link with your second question, which is, what happens in 21-22? Of course, the 1.2 is our forecast as of now for this year. We don't set a target for 21, for 22. What you can just mechanically expect is that the pricing increase as we see today, will continue to produce some positive, incremental positive results. But we don't want to quantify at all the and it's we don't expect a minus for 21. It's we expect mechanically a plus, but we don't want to quantify it today.
Let's have a look at the last question, which was around, is volatility actually going down?
So the horizontal line is the best estimate in terms of CAT charge in our forecast today. So if you were to draw the line more on the left-hand side, we would come with 1 out of 2 years with everything at 800. So when you look at what happened in 19, you see that our experience was much above 1 billion. It was between, so 1 out of 5 or 1 out of 10 years. We were not far away from 1.3 billion, something like this, net of insurance. So the supplementary measures we have taken is are now bring us to a result, which is the right, the dark blue bar, which shows a decrease in terms of volatility of around 25%. And second, what is interesting is that you see that there is an impact short term for the 1 in 5, but it's flattening as well up to, you know, 1 out of 50. So it's a very, it's, and this is where it's the most effective, especially if you look at the euro numbers. So when looking back at 18 and 19, we would have saved in 19 $100 million, in 18 $200 million. So there is a real impact at the Excel level.
Yeah, that's very clear. Thank you.
Let's move over to this side. Farah, let's...
Can't see, sorry. From Bernberg. I had a question. So you mentioned that so Excel earnings will go up. It sounded as if life earnings will go up because they were a bit depressed this year. It sounds as if asset management also, you're very confident. If I add all these, I get to a billion more, which would mean that your earnings would be up like 13, 14% this year. And I just wondered, is there anything I'm missing, either on the plus or maybe on the negative side here? The other thing is on the debt. So you have a slide where you use the word limit, limit down, I hope, of cutting the leverage to the bottom end of the target range, 25%. And I just wondered what will nudge you in you know, at what stage will you decide, oh, we'll do the maximum or we'll do the minimum, and what will influence that decision? And the last question is for France, which seems to be the star of the show today. Is the how sustainable is that 1.7 billion? What can we expect this year?
Etienne, three questions for you.
Thank you. Maybe you missed the contribution of AXA Equitable Holdings, if I understand your question well. So you will have positives from so asset management, even if it grows up, it will not be very significant in absolute numbers. But the contribution of AXA Equitable will disappear fully next year. So I think this is the maybe the missing element in your projection. Second, on the level of debt, I would say it's pretty simple. I told you the main value driver is reduction of debt, but you must have available debt, if you see what I mean. So debt where we have the possibility to reimburse in advance. So if you make the maths, you will understand what kind of number we are talking about, and then it's purely a question, and this is an information we cannot disclose, what are the debt, specific debt we are going to reimburse. And your third question...
Yeah, it was for Jacques. AXA France, is 1.7 billion sustainable? I think that was the question. Huh?
Thank you very much for the question. Concerning AXA France, we have a very, very solid engine that is growing each year at the same level. So it's not new that we are performing. So the question is, are we going to perform in the long term? Definitely yes. If you look at, for example, the P&C business. The P&C business, we are at 90 combined ratio now. But if you look at what are the The lever of the improvement is definitely very strong lever. It's lever concerning the current year, reduction of claims, and that is due to our underwriting, which is each day improving, and it's also due to the decrease of the expense ratio, and that is just the fruit of the work we are always doing in order to be better. And if you look now at the life business, we are at a tipping point now, and we are jumping in a new era where we have a wonderful, wonderful potential of growth. And this potential rely on four pillars that you have to have in mind. First is the reform of the pension in France. And this reform is done. It's not the reform that is discussing now at the Assembly. I am speaking about the reform done that went into effect in October with the PACTE law. This has created a tremendous potential of development of our volumes, but also of our profitability. We, as you know, just as a reminder, we have now an attractive product. You can go upon retirement with a lump sum. You have portability. You have the keeping, let's say, of the favorable fiscal treatment. And on this market, the pension market in France, we are leader with roughly 18% market share. And if you look at the expectation of the government on this market, the government expects to go from, in 3 years, by 2022, to go from 220 billion euro asset under management to 300 billion euro asset under management. It's a 40% growth in 2 years. And if you look at the revenues that involve, it's a triple of the revenue each year to reach this target. And if you look at the first months on this new market that is opening, and you look at it, on the first 3 months, we have increased our revenue by 60%. And if you look at our market share, it's even more than the last market share we used to have. Our market share is 22%. And if you look at the end, and if you know that this market has a 60% plus unit link rate compared with the market we have in saving with, let's say, a 27 UL rate at the market, you can calculate with math what will give for the leader in France who has a very strong track record on this market and in taking the opportunity. And you know that we have been the first one in France to deliver this product a few days after the law took into effect. Second pillar, Eurocroissance. Eurocroissance is now 200 million of euro. It is increased by 40% compared with last year. And this Eurocroissance, I think that in the shift of the behavior that our client must have in her head due to the change of the environment of low interest, this Eurocroissance will be a very strong answer, a very strong response to what they need, because it will permit them to have a guarantee at the end of the contract, 8 years, but also to have a potential of a good performance. The third pillar is innovation. Innovation on health. We have a large boulevard in front of us, because you know that we have always had a very good UL rate in France, in AXA France, compared with our peers. And I can tell you that this year, with 39% UL rate, we have even grown the gap between us and the market. The gap is now 11 points, and we can still grow it through innovation. Innovation, we did it with structured fund. That was in the early 20s. But we did also in 2012 with real estate. We will do it with private equity in the few months, thanks to the law pact that have softened, let's say, the rules concerning private equity in AV. And the last, but not the least, will concern our contract, the term of our contract. We are able to adapt the term of our contract to the low environment we face, the low rate environment we face. We can modify this term in order to adapt the guarantee to what we can serve. And also the last one, the underwriting policy. You know that all the French insurers are taking now more stringent policy underwriting to raise the unit link rate. So thanks to our track record, thanks to our expertise, thanks to the strong links we have with AXA Invest Manager in France, we are very, very confident in the capacity we have to grow the underlying earning in the coming years.
Thank you, Jacques Michael. You must be convinced now. So let's just move forward here.
Thank you, Colm Kelly, UBS. Most of my questions have been asked and answered, but I have a few remaining. In AXA XL, to what extent have the changes announced today impacted on the diversification benefit you expect to achieve with the merger of the internal models? So, you know, the risk exposure here is measured by the best estimate liability has increased, but also there's an accelerated mix shift that is different to what was expected at outset from the transaction. So, you know, to what extent will that impact on the capital synergies as dictated by the diversification credit? And then secondly, related to that, you have the guidance for capital synergies of 5 to 10 percentage points, but I suppose what's driving that confidence ahead of discussions with the ACPR around what that number will end up at? I mean, it's difficult to predict what the outcome of those discussions between regulatory authorities and companies will be, and the diversification credit is always a key lever of change in those discussions. Then lastly, on the operating free cash flow, which I typically use as a good measure of dividend progression and capacity, the operating free cash flow was down 5% this year, but hasn't either exhibited growth over, you know, since 2015, it was pretty much the same number. So, how important is this in setting the dividend? I mean, it's the cumulative free cash flow is one of the main targets within the Ambition 2020 plan. It's not exhibiting any growth at the moment. So I suppose, how is that supporting confidence to grow the dividend at 7% this year? And when I look at the next plan, how does that give me confidence in a progressive dividend strategy within that plan if the cash flows themselves are not exhibiting growth? Thank you.
So before Alban is answering the first two questions, let us remind ourselves that we're here to discuss the full year results 2019 and not the plan 2021 to something. So when we are ready to discuss the plan, we should go back to the question around cash flow. I don't know if Etienne wants to make a statement afterwards concerning Ambition 2020, but let's be clear, we're not talking about the plan today. Alban, on the question about diversification benefit, business mix shift, and then the question on the capital synergies, what is our confidence?
So your question on the change in business mix and its impact on the model, it's a bit the same question as the one earlier on the release of capital or the absence thereof. It's not significant enough, that change, to impact the amount of capital that we need to hold at group level. So don't expect a change coming from that shift. And on your second question, we started the discussions with the ACPR. We have explained to them how we plan to integrate Excel in the internal model. Now, those discussions are still being held. We have not come to a conclusion yet, and I would say nothing leads me to believe that the 5 to 10 points is wouldn't be achieved. But I don't want to put pressure on the ACPR by saying this, and so that will come in the next month.
Good. Let's move on. Let's go here. Sorry, I can't. Yeah, the cash one, I think I just checked with Etienne. We'll come back to that when we talk about the plan, because for the existing period, you have seen 28 to 32 billion. We are at 25. There should be no reason to believe that we are not achieving the range that is targeted for Ambition 2020. And what everything else that concerns afterwards, let's deal with it when we talk about the afterwards.
Thank you. Thomas Fossard from HSBC. Two questions left on XL. Sorry to come back to this one. The first question would be regarding the claims inflation you are seeing coming into your book. Actually, could you help us to better understand how this compares to the 8% price increase in commercial lines, or even better, how the claims inflation is currently versus the 14% price increase that you have recorded in Q4 standalone? That will help us to better understand what is the potential underwriting margin improvement in 2020 or 2021 that you're talking about. The second question would be related to slide B17, where in fact you're splitting XL by different business lines. Sorry to insist again, but I think that from this slide, it's still difficult for us to understand what is XL exposure to the most tricky line of the U.S. casualty market at the present time. What do you have in terms of business on lead umbrella, on excess liability, which is a part of the book where you're insuring Fortune 500 in the U.S.? I think that this type of granularity we're still missing. And also on the premium in the reinsurance side, where you've got other 3.5 billion, what is the volatility of the business which is behind? Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much. Etienne Albon, do you want to talk about the first question? Who takes it? Albon?
Yeah. So on claims inflation, I think the main message that we want to give is we do believe that we are ahead of the trend, i.e. that the price increases are greater than the claims inflation that we're seeing. That's a very strong message. But then when you look at the claims inflation and the price increases, what we see, the price increase that you show, that we showed, is an average. On excess casualty in the U.S., as Thomas said at the beginning, we see a 40% price increase in January, 40%, 40. And so depending on the layer you're at and the business you're in, you would not have the same price increase because you wouldn't see the same claims inflation. Obviously, when you are in the umbrella layers, you do see a significant claims inflation, but that's also where the price increases are greatest, and that's also a place where we have significantly reduced the layers there. Typically, on that one, we used to provide a 25 million capacity. We now provide a 10 million capacity. So that's the kind of underwriting measures that we have taken on umbrella, but same on others. But obviously, not all of them are affected the same way by claims inflation, and therefore our price increases need to be selective. But it's significant.
Thank you, Albon. Scott, maybe this is an opportunity for you to talk a little bit about XL and by business line. And I think it would also be important to shed a bit of light on the social inflation is not a general problem everywhere. It's very focused on some parts, like rail, like commercial auto. Could you talk a little bit about that so we get it more into perspective?
Yes, and in the casualty number, you see that is a basket, as Albon says. That's a basket of goods. There's motor in there. Our work comp book, we have United States, is in there. And so it's a geographically spread book plus different products. It's not just excess casualty in the United States. But, yeah, so social inflation, there's lots of conversation about that. It affects, as Albon says, the excess casualty, particularly on the larger risks, more prevalently than the smaller middle market accounts, right? Then it's just the jury awards you see in the United States and the tendency for the plaintiff's bar to ask for more money from bigger companies. You can see it in the settlements, and you can see it in the court cases. So, you know, it is not a universal number across the entire portfolio that says everything goes up. But it is still all going up. It just goes up at different levels.
Right. Let's move on.
Hi, it's Cameron Hussein from RBC. On results bingo, I guess we haven't hit coronavirus yet, so let me just ask about that.
Took a long time.
In terms of, I guess, being prepared for, you know, I think we can probably ignore the claims environment and, you know, due to coronavirus. But if you look at SARS post that happening back in the early 2000s, there was a huge spike up in kind of health sales following that. How prepared are you to kind of take advantage of that? That's the first question. The next key, sadly, are both on XL. Coming back to the 0.6 billion, to what extent are you already recognising what you hope are margin improvements on long tail price improvements there? So you would say, you know, we've seen claims inflation spike. To what extent do you think that doesn't happen again? And the second question is, that slide on cat exposures is fantastic, but I would expect that your kind of average nat cat number should probably come down, because on a 1 in 5 year basis it comes down quite a lot. So is the 4% nat cat number for AXA XL still the right one going forward? Thank you.
Good, thank you very much. I'll do the coronavirus one, and then Etienne, if you could do the other ones on the 0.6 billion and the margin improvement and the question around does the cat exposure come down. So on the coronavirus, look, the short term is certainly that we are being affected by it, both operationally, so just to understand, people cannot work anymore in the company, they have to work from home, which causes always operational difficulties. We have been dealing with it both in Hong Kong and in China. You see that because people don't leave their home anymore, there is also a negative impact on sales. Luckily, we've been investing significantly on our digital capabilities. So, for example, in Hong Kong, we've launched a service still under the leadership of Etienne at the time called Emma, where we have most services being digitally present, and the digital interaction numbers have skyrocketed. So that is actually very good to see that if you can't move physically anymore, you can still move on a digital basis. You are absolutely right that a reminder function of this crisis means that people are thinking more about health. And when I think about the upside, that is exactly that. We are focusing on expanding our health business with now the fully owned AXA Tianping. You've probably seen that we have launched three products recently that are exactly focusing on the health area, always in combination of I've got a health insurance offer plus I've got a physical offer of healthcare delivery, in this case with Tencent Trusted Doctors. So yes, we see a great opportunity once the dust is settled and we're getting back to normality, and that is exactly where we want to focus on. Etienne, on the other two questions.
So 0.6, the famous now 0.6 XL. What I can tell you, I can reiterate, in the 0.5 starting point, we have minus 0.2 of casualty deviation. We didn't touch this because we think there is a lag between the pricing, some lag between the pricing and the effect on the recognition of the claims inflation. So the 0.6 reflects a level of price increase which is substantial and which is supposed to grow more or less in line with the further potential inflation. So this is an estimate that you have a lot of assumptions behind that, as you can imagine. And I take the opportunity just to come back to a question which was related to the page B17 on the casualty line, and saying that around 20% refers to the lines particularly hit by the social inflation. So if I come back to the question number three, which is the cat exposure, I would say that the main benefit of what we are doing is to reduce the volatility. This being said, it's true that the average load of a catnat net has come back from a sort of 4% plus to a 4% minus, which is mechanical mathematically. However, in our forecast, we are very near to still to the 4%. The main benefit comes from the volatility.
So, last question. And Andrew Crean, you've got the mic, so I can't prevent you from asking that question. Go ahead.
Three questions. Only one on XL.
That's a record.
So, firstly, actually going back, and this is on XL, going back to James Shuck's question, I think the 0.8 billion excess over best estimate is a 2% margin, which looks a bit scarily low. Is it right to apply it against all the reserves of XL rather than just the casualty lines? I noticed that the PGAP reserve of a billion was applied just to the casualty line, in which case you get a margin of 5%, which is slightly more comforting. And then secondly, coming back to Com's question, could you address the question related to 2019 as to why the cash flow went down 5% in 2019? So we're not looking forward too far. And then thirdly, your reinvestment rate on new business, I think, was 2% in the first half, 1.7% in the second in the full year. So it was about 1.4% in the second half, and it's probably now down at about 1%. What is the outlook for investment margins? Do you intend to keep cutting crediting rates to maintain your margin, or do you look to the fact that the policyholder is getting a rather bad deal?
Thank you, Andrew, for those three questions. I suggest, Etienne, you take the first two. So the question around do we have to relate the reserves to casualty only or the total? Second question as well, why has the cash flow gone down in 2019? And then Alban, you take the question on the reinvestment rate and also maybe link to the question of the crediting rate and if you need some help from Jacques, because that is very much linked to France, we can happily do that. Etienne.
So the PGAP identified a certain number of risks at the end of 2018, most of them being related to casualty. But of course, they are basically unallocated. The 0.6 this year are focused on the liability lines, on the casualty lines, because those are the ones where we observed a deviation. So the 0.8 is left open. I expect that the big bulk of it will be there to cover casualty lines, because we don't see negative or much less negative deviations on the other lines. Second, fundamentally, if we want to increase our earnings and dividend at 5%, let's take that as a sort of average, of course, the cash upstream, the operating cash upstream, will have to grow to follow this path going forward. It's purely logical. So then from year to year, you have some variations related to specific country situations, which are, I would say, non-recurring. So generally, we share the view that these cash flow streams, more than the operating free cash flow themselves, which is a proxy, have to increase by the same level of pattern than the dividend and the earnings per share.
Alban, on the reinvestment rate.
Thank you. So on the reinvestment rate, you're right in saying that in 2019, the investment rate was around 1.7% on average. We expect the same in 2020. And the way we achieve that is by benefiting from something that Etienne mentioned earlier, which is the expertise of AXA IM in alternatives. So we are progressively increasing the share of alternatives in our balance sheet. We were at 20%. We want to move to 25%. That's a higher yield without more capital, and therefore it's good for everyone. In terms of margin on the life side, so we've done projections with the whole group and notably with AXA France, with the current level of interest rates and reinvestment rate similar to the one I've just described. And over the next 10 years, we believe that we can both keep a margin similar or close to what we have today and still give a very decent return to our policyholders, notably when you compare with the negative interest rates that you would have today on the market.
Good. Thank you, Alban. We unfortunately have to come to an end. I know there is still plenty of questions. We will still be here, so if there is any urgent questions, we can deal with them bilaterally. I want to thank all of you for being here, for your numerous questions. Thanks to my colleagues for having supported us here, and I wish you a great afternoon and hope to see you soon. Thank you.